Originally, I razed that barn to rid myself of the awful memory of what my father and I had witnessed. But now I see the new edifice as more a monument to my own foolishness and stubbornness, a monument to my wasteful, judgmental blunder. My father steadies himself by taking my arm. "When will we get the Vermeer back?" he asks.
"Soon."
"Good. And no more loaning out artwork," he grouses. "It's not like we are big collectors. Our two big masterpieces should never leave Lockwood again."
I disagree with this, but I see no reason to voice that now. I love my father dearly, though objectively there is little to admire about him. He is a standard-issue, trust-fund ne'er-do-well. He inherited great wealth, giving him an array of choices, and his choice has been to spend his life doing exactly what he pleases: golf and tennis, luxury clubs and travel, reading and educational experiences. He drinks too much, though I'm not sure I would call him an alcoholic. He has no interest in work, but then again, why should he? He dabbles in charities the way the wealthy often do, giving enough to appear magnanimous, but not enough to cause the smallest of sacrifices. He cares very much about appearances and reputation. There is an odd psychology amongst those who inherit great wealth, because deep down inside, they realize that they did nothing to earn it, that it really was just a matter of luck, and yet how can it be that they are not special? My father suffers from this malady.
"I have all this," the thinking goes, "ergo I must be somehow superior."
This leads to a constant internal battle to maintain the false narrative of somehow deserving all these riches, of being worthy. You push away the obvious truth that fate and happenstance have more to do with your lot in life than your brilliance or work ethic, so as not to shatter your self-created myth. But my father, and those like him, know the truth, deep down. We all do. It haunts us. It makes us compensate. It poisons.
"On the news," my father begins, "they said the Vermeer was found in a New York City apartment."
"Yes."
"And that the thief was found dead?"
"There is probably more than one thief," I remind him. "But yes, he was murdered."
"Do you know the man's name?"
"Rye Strauss." We don't stop short, but my father slows for a moment, his lips thin. "Do you know him?" I ask.
"The name is familiar."
I briefly explain about the Jane Street Six. He asks a few follow-up questions. We reach the entrance to Lockwood Manor. A woman is dusting in the parlor. When we come in, she vanishes without a word, as she's been trained to do. The indoor staff dress in a brown that matches the wood, the outdoor in a green that matches the lawn, both a camouflage of sorts created by my great-grandmother. The Lockwoods treat help well, but they are always just the help. When I was 12 years old, my father noticed one of our landscapers taking a break to look at the setting sun. My father pointed to the skyline and said to me,
"Do you see how beautiful Lockwood is?"
"Yes, of course," young me replied.
"So do they."
He gestured toward the landscaper.
"That laborer gets to enjoy the same view we do. It isn't different for him, is it? He sees the exact same thing you and I do, that same sunset, that same tree line. Yet, does he appreciate that?"
I don't think I realized at the time how utterly clueless my father was. We are all masters of self-rationalization. We all seek ways to justify our narrative. We all twist that narrative to make ourselves more sympathetic. You do it too. If you are reading this, you were born in the top 1% of history's population, no question about it. You've experienced luxuries that painfully few people in the history of mankind could have even imagined. Yet, instead of appreciating that, instead of doing more to help those beneath you, we attack those who got even luckier for not doing enough. It is human nature, of course. We don't see our own faults. As Ellen Bolitar, Myron's mother, likes to say,
"The humpback never sees the hump in his own back."
Nigel peeks in on us.
Do we need anything? Just some privacy, my father snaps.
He says privacy with the short I, as though he's suddenly British. Nigel rolls his eyes and gives my father a mock salute. To me, he glares a quick warning before closing the doors. We sit across from one another in the red velvet chairs near the stone fireplace. My father offers me a cognac. I pass. He starts to pour his own, but his arm is slow and uncooperative. When I offer to help, he shakes me off. He can manage. It's still early in the morning. You must think he has a drinking problem, but that's not it. He just has nowhere else he needs to be.
Your cousin Patricia was here with you, he says.
Yes.
Why?
She is a member of the family, I say. My father lances me with the blue eyes.
Please, Wynne. Let's not insult my intelligence. Your cousin hasn't been to Lockwood in over 20 years, correct?
Correct.
And it isn't a coincidence that the day the Vermeer is found she came back, is it?
It is not.
So, I want to know why she was here.
This is my father, the somewhat bullying interrogator. I haven't experienced much of this side of him since his stroke. I'm glad to see his ire, even though it is aimed squarely at me. There may be a connection, I say, between the art heist and what happened to her family. Dad's eyes start blinking in astonishment.
What happened to her?
His voice trails off.
You mean her abduction?
And Uncle Aldrich's murder, I add. He winces at his brother's name. We stay silent. He lifts the glass and stares at the amber liquid for far too long.
I don't see how, he says.
I stay still.
The paintings were stolen before the murder, correct?
I nod.
A long time before, if I recall. Months? Years?
Months.
Yet you see a connection. Tell me why.
I do not want to go into details, so I switch topics. What caused the rift between you and Uncle Aldrich? His eyes flare at me from over the crystal.
What does that have to do with anything?
You never told me.
Our...
He takes a moment to think of the word.
Our dissolution took place years before his murder.
I know. I stare into his face. Most people claim that they cannot see family resemblances when it comes to themselves. I can, almost too much. Do you ever think about that?
What do you mean?
If you and Aldrich hadn't, I make quote marks with my fingers, dissolved, do you think he would still be alive today? My father looks stunned, hurt.
My God, Wynne, what a thing to say.
I realize that I'd wanted to draw blood, and apparently I succeeded. Do you ever think about that possibility?
Never,
he says too forcefully.
What has gotten into you?
He was my uncle.
And my brother.
And you threw him out of the family. I want to know why.
It was so long ago.
He raises the glass to his lips, but now it is shaking. My father has gotten old, an obvious observation, alas, but we are often told how aging is a gradual process. Perhaps that's true, but in my father's case, it was more like a plummet off a cliff. For a long time, my father clung to that beautiful edge, healthy, strong, vibrant. But once he slipped, his descent was steep and sudden.
It was so long ago, my father says again.
The pain in his voice is a living thing. The 1,000-yard stare, not all that different from the one I'd seen in that barn so many years ago, is back. I see where he is looking, another blank spot on the wall. Once upon a time, a stunning black-and-white photograph of Lockwood Manor hung in that spot. The photograph had been taken by my Uncle Aldrich sometime in the late 1970s. It, like my uncle, was long gone now. I had never really thought about that until now, that even Uncle Aldrich's artistic contributions to this estate had been scrubbed away when he was hurled out of the family circle. You told me that it was some sort of money issue, I say. You implied Uncle Aldrich embezzled. He doesn't respond. Was that true? He snaps out of it with a fury.
What difference does it make? That's the trouble with your generation. You always want to unearth unpleasantness. You think dragging the ugly out in the sunlight will destroy it. It doesn't. Just the opposite. You give the ugly thing life, nourishment. I never spoke of it. Your uncle never spoke of it. That's what being a Lockwood means. We both knew that many people thrive on our familial misery. They want to exploit any weakness. Do you understand that?
I say nothing.
Your responsibility as a member of this family is to protect our good name.
Dad,
do you hear me, Wynn? The Lockwoods don't air our dirty laundry.
What happened?
Why are you suddenly in touch with Patricia?
Nothing sudden about it, Dad. We've always stayed in touch. He rises. His face is red. His entire body is quaking.
I'm not discussing this any longer.
He is too agitated. I need to calm him. It's okay, Dad,
but I'm reminding you right now that you're a Lockwood. That's an obligation. You inherit the name, you inherit all that comes with it. Whatever happened with this art heist, whatever happened to my brother and Patricia, it has nothing to do with a very old rift between Aldrich and me. Do you understand?
I do, I say in my most tranquil tone, rising from my seat. I hold up my hands in a composed, I'm unarmed gesture. I didn't mean to upset you. The door opens, and Nigel is there.
All okay in here? He sees my father's face. Windsor, I'm fine, damn it.
But Dad doesn't look fine. His face is still flushed, as though from overexertion. Nigel gives me a baleful look.
It's time for your medication, Nigel says.
Dad grabs me by the elbow.
Remember to protect the family.
Then he shuffles out of the room. Nigel stares at me.
Thanks for not upsetting him.
How long were you listening in? I ask. Then I hold up my hand. It doesn't matter.
Do you know what the rift was about?
Nigel takes his time.
Why don't you ask your cousin?
Patricia? He says nothing.
Patricia knows?
Dad stands at the foot of the stairs now.
Nigel!
He shouts.
I need to look after your father, Nigel Duncan tells me. Have a pleasant day.
Chapter 15. My Jaguar XKRS GT is waiting for me. I slide in as my phone buzzes with a text from Kabir. It informs me that a meeting with Professor Ian Cornwell, the watchman who'd been on duty when the paintings were stolen, has been arranged for an hour from now. Kabir hadn't told Cornwell what it was about, just that a Lockwood wanted to meet. Perfect. Kabir drops a pin on the exact location of Cornwell's office at Haverford College, Roberts Hall. I know it. As I drive through the gates of Lockwood, I call Cousin Patricia. She answers on the first ring.
What's up?
No articulate, I say.
I'm nervous. Do you have an update?
Where are you?
At the house.
I'll be by in 10 minutes. Cousin Patricia lives in the same home from when she was abducted and where her father was murdered. It's a modest Cape Cod at the end of a cul-de-sac. She's divorced and shares custody of her 10-year-old son, Henry, though Henry's primary residence is, interestingly enough, with her ex, a renowned neurosurgeon appropriately named Don Quest. The cliché is that Patricia's life is her work, but clichés exist for a reason. She travels a great deal for her charity, the Abiona Shelters, making speeches and doing fundraisers the world over. Patricia was the one who suggested this somewhat unconventional custody arrangement, a fact that makes the local hoity-toity tisk-tisk
over what they want to see as maternal neglect. When I pull into her driveway, Patricia is standing outside on the gravel drive with her mother, my Aunt Aileen. The two women look very much alike, both stunning in similar ways, more like sisters than mother-daughter. Sometime in the 70s, Uncle Aldrich, the progressive in our rather staid family, quit college to spend 3 years doing charity work and photojournalism in South America. This was in the days before those soft, coddling, volunteer-abroad, internship-slash-college-essay-slash-vacation experiences that are all the rage for today's youth. Uncle Aldrich, who had grown up in ridiculous privilege at Lockwood, relished the opportunity to shed his past and live amongst the poorest of the poor in fairly harsh conditions. He learned and grew, so the family legend has it, and with the help of the Lockwood money, Aldrich founded a school in one of the most poverty-stricken areas of Fortaleza. The school still stands today, renamed the Aldrich Academy in his memory. It was there, at this new school in Fortaleza, that Uncle Aldrich met a beautiful young kindergarten teacher named Aileen and fell in love. Uncle Aldrich was 24 years old at the time, Aileen only 20. They returned to Philadelphia a year later, having been married by a shaman of the Yanomami tribe in the Amazon. The Lockwood family was not amused by this development, but Uncle Aldrich made Aunt Aileen his legal wife under American law anyway. Not long after, Patricia was born. Aunt Aileen steps toward me as I get out of the car. Patricia shakes her head at me, a warning, perhaps, not to divulge anything, and I give her the slightest nod in return. "Win," Aileen says, hugging me. "Aunt Aileen. It's been too long." It was Aunt Aileen who found Uncle Aldrich's body in the front foyer of this very house that night. She was the one who called 911. I've heard the tape of that call. Aileen distraught, hysterical, her voice occasionally breaking into Portuguese. She kept screaming Aldrich's name, as though she hoped to rouse him. At the time of the call, Aileen hadn't yet realized that her 18-year-old daughter had been kidnapped. That realization, the realization that the nightmare of finding her husband murdered was only the beginning, would come later. I oft wonder how Aileen coped. She had no family here, no real friends, and, of course, the police found her decision to go shopping by herself late suspicious. When Patricia didn't come home that night, there were those who whispered that Aileen had offed her own daughter, too, and hidden the body. Others believed that cousin Patricia was in on it somehow, that mother and daughter had murdered the father, and now Patricia was in hiding. People want to believe these sorts of things. They want to believe that there is a reason for such tragedies, that the victim is in some way to blame, that there exists a rationale beyond chaos, and thus said tragedies can't happen to them. It comforts us to think that we have control when we don't. As Myron always quotes, "Man plans, God laughs." "I know you two need to talk," Aunt Aileen says, still with a hint of a Brazilian accent. "So I'm going to take a walk." Aileen power strides up the drive wearing running shoes, a tight lycra top, and yoga pants. I watch her for a moment, impressed with what I see, as Patricia sidles next to me. "Are you ogling my mother?"
"She's also my aunt," I say.
"That's not really an answer." I kiss her cheek, and we step inside. We now stand in the foyer where her father was killed. Neither of us is superstitious, so it isn't a question of bad luck or ghosts or whatever woo-woo nonsense often sends people away from something like this. But I have always wondered about something more concrete, the memory. Patricia, who lives here alone, had watched her father get murdered in this spot. Isn't that something to avoid? Years ago, I asked her about that. "I like the reminder. It fuels me." Her devotion to the cause crosses the border into obsession, but that is the case with most worthwhile endeavors. Cousin Patricia and the Abiona shelters she has built do good.
Legitimately. I know her work well and support it. I tell her all that I've learned. The wall in this front foyer is something of a shrine to Patricia's father. Uncle Aldrich took photography somewhat seriously, and while I don't know much about how such things are judged, his work is considered substantial. The foyer is loaded up with black-and-white prints, mostly ones he took during his long sojourn in South America. The subjects are varied: landscapes, urban squalor, indigenous tribes. To complete the shrine effect, the framed photographs surround a single shelf that holds but one item, Uncle Aldrich's beloved camera, a rectangular-shaped Rolleiflex with twin lenses, the kind you hold at chest level rather than up to your eye. That's how I still see Aldrich clearest when I think back on him, with this camera that seemed dated even in its heyday, carefully snapping portraits of the family and, as I mentioned earlier, Lockwood Estate in general. "What's our next step?" Patricia asks when I finish. "I'm going to talk to the security guard at Haverford who was tied up during the art heist." She frowns. "Why?" "We now have a link between the Haverford heist and what happened in this very room. We have to go back and review it all."
"I guess that makes sense."
She doesn't sound convinced. I ask her why.
"I never put what happened here fully behind me, of course," she says, weighing her words before they leave her mouth. "But over the years, I think I've successfully channeled it."
I tell her she has.
I just don't want anything interrupting that."
"Not even the truth?" I say, realizing how overly melodramatic that sounds.
"I'm curious, of course, and I want justice, but..."
Her voice trails off. "Interesting," I say.
"What?" "My father wants me to drop this, too."
"Whoa, Wynn, I'm not saying I want you to drop it." Then, thinking about it, she adds,
"Is your father worried how this will all reflect on the family?"
"Always and forever."
"And that's why you're here?"
"I'm here to see you," I say, "and to find out why our fathers fell out."
"Did you ask your father?"
"He won't tell me."
"What makes you think I know?"
I look directly at her. "You're stalling, for one thing." She turns away from me, walks toward the sliding glass door, and peers out into the backyard.
"I don't see how any of this is relevant."
"Oh, good," I say.
"What?"
"More stalling."
"Don't be an ass."
I wait.
"Do you remember my sweet 16?
"I do." It had been a lavish, albeit tasteful, affair at Lockwood. I say tasteful because a number of our nouveau riche friends tried to outdo one another with expensive cars and name rock bands and zoo safaris and celebrity appearances and, "Sir, show me gauche." Patricia, on the other hand, only had her closest friends attend for a simple evening on the lawn at Lockwood.
"We did a girl's sleepover," she says, "in tents, down by the pond. There were 8 of us."
I put myself back into that moment. I'd gone to the dinner portion of the Sweet 16, but the boys were then dismissed. I headed back to the main house. What I recall most about the event was that a lovely lass named Babs Stellman had attended, and that someone had told me she had a crush on me. Naturally, I tried to, what's the term, score. Babs and I did manage to sneak away for a bit and necked behind a tree. She smelled wonderfully of pert shampoo. I remember moving my hand under her sweater, though she stopped me from going any further with the always paradoxical line, "I really like you, Wynn."
"The girls all got undressed in the gazebo," Patricia continues. She lowers her head. "And your father, he was wrong, Wynn. I need you to know that. But your father accused my father of watching us through a window."
I freeze, having trouble believing what I'm hearing. "Say that again?" Patricia almost smiles.
"Now who's stalling?"
"You mean, as in my father accusing your father of being a peeping Tom?"
"Yes,
That's exactly what I mean.
My father wouldn't make that up, I say.
No, to be fair, he wouldn't. Do you remember Ashley Wright?
I have a vague recollection. She was on your field hockey team?
Patricia nods. Ashley was the one who got upset. She wouldn't say why. She started crying that she wanted to leave. It was all pretty weird. Anyway, her parents picked her up. When she got home, Ashley told her father that she saw my father peeking in the window when she was naked. Ashley's father went to your father. When your father confronted mine, well, fireworks. My dad denied it. Your dad pressed him. It just escalated from there. It opened up a lot of old wounds.
I mull this all over for a moment. Ashley Wright, I say.
What about her?
Was she lying?
Patricia opens her mouth, closes it, tries again. What difference does it make now, Wynne?
She has a point. Do you know where she lives now?
Ashley Wright?
Her face blanches.
Geez, I don't know.
What, you want to talk to her?
Seriously, Wynne? Suppose my dad was, worst-case scenario, a pervert who peeped on 16-year-old girls. What difference would that make now?
Another good point. Where am I going with this? His murder and Patricia's abduction took place 2 years after this. I could see zero connection.
And yet... Wynne?
I look at her. Patricia's eyes are on that wall, on that camera, on the photographs.
I miss my father like hell. I want justice. And the fact that the man who hurt me, who did that to all those girls, could still be doing this, that's haunted me for over 20 years.
I wait.
But it now seems pretty clear that Ry Strauss did both, right? And if that's the case, maybe we don't want this dug up.
Again, she sounds like my father.
I nod at her. What?
You want this to go away, I say.
Of course I do.
It won't. I remind her that in a few hours, the world will know about Ry Strauss's death and the Jane Street Six and their link to the stolen Vermeer. It is only a question of time before the connection to that suitcase gets figured out by the FBI, or her connection in this is outed in some other way. I watch her deflate as I tell her all of this. Patricia moves toward me and sits hard on the couch. I know how this is going to go. She just needs to process. Finally, she says,
I got to come home. I can never forget that.
Patricia starts to chew her thumbnail, a move I remember from our childhood.
I got to come home, she says again. Those other girls never did. Some. We still haven't found their bodies.
She looks up at me. But what can I add to that?
I've made it my life mission to rescue kids in need. And here I am, cowering in the dark.
I realize that I've been queued up to say something comforting here, such as, I understand, or it's okay. Instead, I check my watch, do a quick calculation of how long it will take me to get to Haverford College, and say, I have to go. As she walks me to the JAG, I see her working the thumbnail again.
What is it? I ask. I never thought it mattered. I still don't.
But? I prompt, sliding into the driver's seat.
But you kept harping on about our father's rift.
What about it?
You think it's relevant.
Correction. I don't know whether it's relevant. I don't know what, if anything we're looking into, is relevant.
This is how I was taught to investigate. You ask questions, you poke around, and perhaps you jar something loose. They spoke one last time.
Who spoke one last time?
Your dad and mine, here, at the house.
When?
Patricia wills her hand to her side so she won't bite the thumbnail again. The night before my father was murdered.
Chapter 16. Founded in 1833, Haverford College is a small, elite, undergraduate institution located along the Tony main line of Philadelphia, adjacent to my two favorite exclusive clubs, the Marion Golf Club, I play a lot of golf, and Marion Cricket Club,